From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine on New York State government and politics. Your host is Don Decker, with commentary by political scientist Dr. Alan Shartok.
Hello, and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. Coming up in this week's show, the annual battle over the death penalty began, and there were some interesting twists and turns. We'll tell you about that. Also, controversies brewing over a newly introduced bill which is designed to end abuse of the elderly by healthcare aides. But some in the healthcare profession say that such abuse is not a problem in the Empire State. And according to some critics, New York's tough new smoking law is not tough enough. We'll have that story plus a lot more on this week's Legislative Gazette. It's become an annual ritual at the Capitol. That's right, the push to reinstate the death penalty in New York began again this week with a vote in the Senate, and as Inga Sarda reports, it was a mix of the expected and the unexpected.
There wasn't anything surprising about the outcome of the Senate's death penalty vote. As always, it passed 40-20. But the approval came after 2.5 hours of debate, which even the bill's sponsor, Dale Volker, admits had some interesting turns.
Well, it was clear from the way in which the minority Democrats talked about life without parole, that there was an organized attempt to push life without parole, which is supporting the governor's position, and even a number of pro-death penalty people talked about life without parole, which is certainly something a little bit new. But we calculated that part of the problem was that there are three or four Democrats, minority Democrats, who have voted against the death penalty who are wavering. And part of the reason for the life without parole speeches and so forth was to try to keep their colleagues in line, because there was a fear that a number of Democrats would bolt and vote for the death penalty.
Buffalo area Senator Dale Volker. There was another interesting element. For the second year in a row, this annual battle focused on Republican Senator James Donovan of Utica. He has been a longtime death penalty supporter, but last year, you may recall, a bout with cancer caused him to rethink his position. This year, he was absent for the vote. Again, Senator Volker.
Well, Senator Donovan is going to, I'm not surprised, really. I kind of anticipated he wouldn't be there for the opening vote. I still expect that in the end he'll do the right thing and vote for the death penalty as he has for some 20 years. So I'm quite confident that in the end he'll vote for it, although I would also put a caution there that I think there is still a very, very strong possibility that the 41st vote will come from somebody who yesterday voted against the death penalty.
Senator Donovan was not available to speak with us after the vote, but his aide Ed Byrne was. He says the senator was ill that day, but admits he is still undecided.
I don't know if he's made up his mind. As of last Friday, he had not made up his mind. We discussed the death penalty thoroughly, and I know he knows that there are two very well-reasoned sides to the issue. I just think at this point, I don't know at this point. As of Friday, he had not made up his mind.
Meanwhile, the Senate majority is now taking flack for not allowing a vote on Cuomo's proposed life without parole measure. Spokesman Bill Stevens says Majority Leader Ralph Marino will not allow such a vote until the death penalty becomes a reality. He also rejects the notion that if Cuomo's measure was in place, there would be no need for a death penalty.
The senator does not believe that. He believes that the death penalty is a necessary protection, for instance, for corrections officers. He also believes that the death penalty does send a message above and beyond life without parole. He uses, for example, the idea that if you ask a person on death row whether they would agree to serve the rest of their natural life or continue their appeals to escape the death penalty, they inevitably will continue their appeals to escape the death penalty. And so he believes that there is that the death penalty is important, first of all, because it does provide a measure, a degree of deterrence to a person serving a life term.
The Senate action begins what's become an annual ritual at the state capitol. Every year, both houses of the legislature pass the death penalty bill. The governor vetoes it, and legislators then count noses to see if they've got enough votes for an override. Thus far, they've come up short. The measure now goes to the Assembly, where a vote is not expected on the bill until late February or March at the earliest. Only after that will it go to Cuomo for his promised veto. The 1990 death penalty battle has taken on additional meaning because the governor's job and all 211 seats in the legislature go before the voters in November. As in the past, Republicans are expected to make Cuomo's opposition to the death penalty a major campaign issue. In fact, the potential Republican candidate drawing the most attention statewide is former federal prosecutor Rudolph Giuliani, and he's a strong proponent of the death penalty. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Inga Sarda.
The deficit in this year's New York State budget could be $400 million higher than the Cuomo administration has previously acknowledged. The new estimates come from fiscal aides in the Democratic-controlled Assembly. It's based largely on the fact that income tax collections for the month of January were well below projections. The new figures would bring the 1989-90 budget deficit to just over $1 billion. Aides to the governor have said that the Assembly figures are not off the wall. Meanwhile, our political analyst, Dr. Alan Chartok, spoke with the governor himself about the latest figures.
I think, I don't know what the Speaker Miller's staff found or said, and that, frankly, is interesting, but it's not the way I'm going to make my judgment. I think there is nothing that was unanticipated. I think if you go back to January 17, when I presented the budget, I said very clearly that I was presenting it on January 17 because that's what the Constitution called for, but that the fact was that in order to meet the constitutional requirement, which I have every year and I didn't want to not meet this year, in order to meet it, I had to give up knowledge of the January revenues because we were only in the middle of the month and we didn't have them. I also went on to say that in all likelihood, I don't remember my exact words, in all likelihood, you will find that the revenues will continue downward, and we will have to cut even more. We will have to reduce spending even more than I propose in this budget, and I will be back to you. And I think I said that three times on the same day to the reporters, to the legislature, and to editors and publishers. So there is no question that this was anticipated, and I said so. It is good that the majority party in the Assembly, the Democrats and the Speaker, recognize this. The Speaker has recognized it for a long time. It also seems to me that without committing himself, Senator Marino, the Republican leader, has at least acknowledged the possibility that, yes, indeed, maybe the governor was right. Maybe we don't have the revenues we'd like to have. It's also a fact that this is true throughout the region, that in New Jersey and elsewhere, you'll see the same complaint about deteriorating revenues.
Political analyst Dr. Alan Chartok speaking with Governor Cuomo. Each year, hundreds of thousands of elderly people are abused by family members and health care aides. That's what top state officials claim this week, and they've introduced legislation to end the problem. But as Bruce Robertson reports, health care organizations are denying that abuse is a problem in the Empire State. One official is even suggesting political motivations may be involved.
According to State Senator Dean Skelos, a Republican from Nassau, abuse of the elderly is varied and widespread.
Well, abuse can take many forms. It can be physical, but it can also be psychological. With the elderly, it can be stealing their money. With an individual in a home health care, nursing home, for example, it could be over-medicating the person just to keep them quiet. That's called pharmacological abuse. So it takes many, many different forms. And what we're trying to do with these individuals who are frail, who have disabilities, protect them with the backing of the law to make sure that they can live their lives in dignity.
State Senator Dean Skelos, co-sponsor of the new bill. Meanwhile, New York State Attorney General Robert Abrams says current law contains too many loopholes to protect sufficiently the elderly.
There are
interpretations of the law, case decisions and gaps, which makes it quite difficult. Don't forget you're talking about people who are frail, who are elderly, who are easily intimidated, who may have vision problems. There are certain requirements about proof of physical injury to be able to demonstrate certain crimes. And this takes into account, I think, all of the unique circumstances of the targeted population here. And I think gives the chance for better protection of them. And just as importantly, I think by adoption of these kinds of provisions, it sends out a signal, a message to nursing home operators, to those who are involved in this kind of care, that any wrongful and inappropriate behavior will simply not be tolerated.
State Attorney General Robert Abrams. Senator Skello says in addition to closing some of those loopholes, this new bill will specifically make it a crime to abuse the elderly.
Well, presently, for a person to be prosecuted, generally they'd have to be prosecuted under assault statutes or for violating certain health regulations. What this law would specifically do is make it either a Class E felony, which means you can go to jail for over a year, or a Class D felony, which increases the penalty even more in the event there is this type of harm to an individual. It makes it easier for district attorneys to prosecute.
State Senator Dean Skelos. But not everyone agrees that abuse of the elderly is widespread. In fact, Carl Young, president of the New York Association of Homes and Services for the Aging, vigorously denies that charge. And he says the issue could certainly be one of semantics.
As I said, there's been evolving within the long-term care profession a lot of discussion on how best to reduce the use of restraints in nursing homes. Restraints are those generally physical, often they're ties put on people to keep them from falling. And, you know, the rationale behind restraints is to protect the resident. As the profession has evolved and the care of the elderly has evolved, we've come to appreciate that wherever possible, we should try to minimize the use of those physical restraints, and either through design of equipment or design of facilities or other types of treatment, maybe we can reduce that dependency. Well, in the mind of some, the use of any restraint constitutes abuse, where that's where I think the issue of semantics comes. There are people who are out on one end who say that there should be no use of restraints whatsoever, and that if you are using restraints, you're abusing patients. Well, there are others who acknowledge that there are cases where you do need to have some kind of physical restraints, because depending on the circumstance of the patient, they could be harmful to themselves, harmful to other patients if there weren't some kind of restraint being used.
And Young suggests that there could also be some political motivations on the part of the Attorney General as well.
And their national association has identified these issues as good issues for elected attorney generals to be proclaiming on. Now, I don't know what studies he's talking about. If he's talking about studies in New York State, none of us have seen them, and I don't dispute at all that there are places in this country where patients are not well cared for. But between the professionalism of the providers and the efforts of the Department of Health to keep close watch on the facilities in New York State...
Carl Young, president of the New York Association of Homes and Services for the Aging. Despite such opposition, the bill's sponsors say they feel there is a good chance the measure will become law, although it failed to gain approval in years past. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
Our political analyst, Dr. Alan Chartok, professor at the State University of New York, is back with us again. Alan, what do you think about the death penalty arguments this week that seem to take a little bit of a twist, a new turn in the arguments? They spend an awful lot of time on the subject of the life without parole as well. That played a big role in this.
Well, remember that you're dealing with a political expert here who comes in second to no one in terms of argumentation. And one of the things that the governor believes is you keep saying it over and over and over again, and pretty well, pretty soon it begins to play out.
You mean the governor's second to no one? Is that who you're
talking
about?
That's correct.
I thought maybe you were talking about yourself. Go ahead.
Pretty good. Now the governor is so good at this that what happens is he's politically vulnerable, of course, because huge majorities in the state want the death penalty. And believe it's right. I'm being stopped on the street, by the way, at least recently, because people know me and say, you know, what about the death penalty? I'm for it. I wish he'd sign it. Why isn't he signing? That's the first time I've seen that. But now he's got them in a sort of a logical positioning in which he's saying to the Republicans, well, look, you're not going to get the death penalty. So why not have, in the meantime, until you can have your death penalty, have life without parole? Don't let these guys out. And you're really not voting for life without parole. You're really voting down the security of New York State citizens. And for the first time, I find people buying that. I'm saying, well, he's right. You're not going to have the death penalty. At least you keep these people who have murdered and who are going to probably murder again segregated for the rest of their lives. One of the interesting things during the week, by the way, is we had this poignant story about this fella who now has terminal cancer, who wants a clemency from Cuomo so that he, quote, doesn't die in his cell. And you better believe political machines are saying in Cuomo's head, Don, as they're spinning around, if I let this guy out, well, what does that say commitment about life without parole?
Right. I read a column by a columnist in the Capital District who said that the legislature wouldn't want it to happen for one moment that the death penalty would be put into law, because then they would be responsible for determining whether or not it works. That what they really want is this annual argument to bash Cuomo over the head, and that they don't ever really want to see it happen. Yes. What do you think about that philosophy?
Well, I think that's probably right. That's called giving up the issue. In other words, there's a point at which you don't want to win a political battle, because then it goes away, and it's better to have it over the other guy's head. I'll give you an example on the other side. Cuomo, in the ethnic violence bill, wants the inclusion of homosexuals. All of the homosexual community that I've talked to are really strong on this, and they think Cuomo is doing the right thing. Now, if in fact the Republicans who are showing signs of this, who've gotten themselves into a terrible position, do not include homosexuals along with blacks, Puerto Ricans, Jews, every other ethnic minority in terms of bashing, then they look terrible to that homosexual community, and they lose what some have estimated is one-tenth of our population in terms of a salient political vote. In other words, we'll vote for this just because it's so important to our group. So now it looks like they may be giving up that issue, and we're seeing some signs of weakening on that. And my guess is that that isn't going to please the governor, although he would slap me across the face a couple of times for this and say, how do you know what's in my head? Because he gives up a tremendous political issue, which allows him to clobber the other guys. And I think your point is quite right. Keeping the issue alive is important in some of these political debates.
Political analyst Dr. Alan Shartok. Saying that many banks near poor neighborhoods discriminate against minorities, two New York State legislators have introduced laws to end the practice. Senator Franz Leichter, a Manhattan Democrat, says that many banks impose geographical limitations on customers.
Say that if you don't live within 10 blocks of the bank or work within 10 blocks of the bank, you can't bank there. Now, these banks that impose these limitations tend to be on the periphery of minority areas. More than that, last year we ran a test. We sent in checkers, some black, some white, some Latinos, and we found out that the rule was applied much more consistently to blacks and Latinos than it was to whites. Whites, in most instances, where the rule was even mentioned to them, were able to talk their way out of it by saying, listen, it's so important for me to be able to bank there.
Leichter says the practice has very bad effects on minorities.
It's inherently biased, has a very adverse effect on minorities who find it difficult enough to find banks where they can bank, because, as we know, and studies that I've released have shown, banks have closed branches in minority areas. Now, if people who don't have any branches in their community go to the neighboring community, and that community says, no, sorry, you can't bank here because you don't live here, where are these people going to bank? It's a bad practice. It needs to be stopped and will be under our legislation.
Assemblyman Herman Farrell, another New York City Democrat, is the sponsor of the measure in that chamber. Just over a month after a strict new state law banning smoking in many public places took effect, anti-smoking advocates say they want more. As Brian Shields reports, they say too many teenagers are illegally purchasing cigarettes, which may be satisfying a deadly habit.
The group made the comments at a news conference this week where it and the New York State Coalition on Smoking and Health called for a complete prohibition on smoking in schools and a halt to the practice many tobacco companies have of handing out free samples of their product. The coalition, which includes the Lung and Heart Associations and the American Cancer Society, says teenagers don't understand the serious consequences of smoking. Spokeswoman Chris Smith.
What we have found out is that although there's a law in the books that says that teenagers are not legally able to buy cigarettes until they're 18 years old, that law is either being disregarded, ignored, or people just simply don't know about it. We did what we are calling a tobacco purchase demonstration project with two area teens. One was a 13-year-old boy, another a 16-year-old girl. We did this last week. We went to 13 places, and in 12 of those places, they got cigarettes, no questions asked, even though in the one case, the young boy clearly is underage. He doesn't even look 13. And in the other case, the 16-year-old looks 16. She looks her age. No questions asked. They just got the cigarettes. Now, the problem is these kids are able to get cigarettes, which we know contain nicotine, which the Surgeon General says is a drug as addictive as heroin. They're able to get them at an age where they can't make health decisions for themselves.
The demands come just 1 month after a strict new law banning smoking in many public places took effect in the state. Assemblyman Alexander Granis will propose a new bill that would accomplish some of the coalition's goals, most notably banning the sale of cigarettes in vending machines.
That's where we want to start. There's a law in the book already that says that these cigarettes can't be sold to people under the age of 18. That law is being ignored, but at least there's a chance it might be complied with because you do have a human being there who is ringing up the sales, who's supposed to ask for ID. That's not happening. We think it really needs to be happening, and we'd like to raise public awareness about the fact that it better start happening soon. But when you come to vending machines, I mean, who's watching? Who's sitting there making sure that kids aren't getting cigarettes anytime they want? There's nobody, and there really can't be anybody. It's unenforceable as to the vending machines. So we say get them out of vending machines. Sure, it would be an inconvenience to people who want to buy cigarettes. I'm sure it's an inconvenience to people who want to buy alcohol that they can't get that out of a vending machine. But that substance is regulated because we know that it's dangerous to underage people, and so are cigarettes.
The coalition says the Granis bill would allow vending machines to dispense cigarettes in some public areas where smoking is still allowed under the new smoking law. These include certain areas in restaurants, bowling alleys, theaters, and hospitals. The Clean Indoor Air Act was passed by the legislature last year after a 13-year battle. It banned smoking in auditoriums, elevators, gymnasiums, and food stores. It also restricts smoking in many other places, such as offices and restaurants. The Granis bill would also prohibit all smoking in schools. Currently, smoking is allowed in faculty lounges, and some high schools have smoking areas for students. The proposed legislation would stop tobacco companies from distributing free samples at sporting events, concerts, and festivals. School districts would be required to pay for students to enter a stop smoking program if they request it. Granis also wants to triple penalties for merchants who sell cigarettes to minors illegally and require permits for all who sell cigarettes so the state can better control the problem. The Tobacco Institute says the ban on cigarette sales and vending machines is totally uncalled for. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brian Shields.
And now taking a look at some other happenings this week in state government, Paul Rosenthal is with us for the Legislative Notebook.
Rudolph Giuliani versus Mario Cuomo. That's what Republican leaders want to see in the upcoming gubernatorial race. A poll published in the New York Post found that 60% of Republican county leaders want the former U.S. attorney to run for governor on the GOP ticket. There are 61 county leaders. Others named as possible contenders include former Avis chief and current GOP chairman Pat Barrett, Manhattan financier Lou Lerman, who ran for governor in 1982 against Governor Cuomo, Congressman David Martin, and former Congressman Barbara Constable. Nobody named Congressman Bill Green of Manhattan, who is considering a gubernatorial run. The poll also found that most people believed it would be difficult or very difficult to defeat Governor Cuomo. Meanwhile, Giuliani says there's only an outside chance he'll run for governor this year. The former federal prosecutor made the comment to editors of the Buffalo News prior to his speech before Erie County Republicans in Cheektowaga this week. About 500 people attended the talk. During the speech and in a subsequent news conference, Giuliani spoke of his vision for America and the state for the year 2000. He said a new approach to government is needed to deal with the serious problems facing the state, like crime, education, and the economy. A major business group has come out against Governor Cuomo's proposal to increase taxes with a suggestion of its own. The New York City Partnership says the state needs to increase productivity and possibly impose a temporary surcharge on corporate and personal income taxes. The group also says the plan to indefinitely delay New Yorkers' promised income tax cuts is bad because corporations would look unfavorably on such a move. Several other business groups, as well as the state Senate's Republican majority, have called for saving the tax cut. Deferral of the tax cut is the centerpiece of Governor Cuomo's $51.3 billion budget proposal. He says it would give the state an extra $400 million in the new budget and nearly $2 billion the next year to help close a potential state budget deficit that could exceed $2 billion. New York State should tax Penthouse instead of Plato and Playboy instead of Plutarch. That call from State Senator Anthony Masiello. The Buffalo Democrat says it's unfair that college students pay taxes on textbooks, but that adult magazines, which he calls optional reading at best, bring no extra tax levy. While Masiello admits the textbook tax brings in big bucks, he has a better idea of how to generate the revenue.
The sales tax on textbooks generated approximately $13 to $15 million to the state of New York. Therefore, to do the responsible thing, we had to find another item that we thought we should tax to make up that revenue. And much to our chagrin, we found that the adult magazines that you buy at bookstores and bookshops and magazine places are tax exempt. So we just found it to be preposterous to tax textbooks and not adult magazines. So we want to shift the tax burden from those who are buying textbooks for the learning process to adult magazines.
By the way, Senator Masiello defines adult magazine as any magazine that must appear in a brown wrapper at a newsstand. The state's top education official wants to change social studies classes in New York to give more emphasis to non-white cultures. State Education Commissioner Thomas Sobel is urging the State Board of Regents to authorize changes that give non-white cultures greater visibility in kindergarten through grade 12. Sobel has also called for the hiring of an ethnically diverse team of nationally recognized experts to assist the State Education Department in revising the curriculum. The move is in response to a report by Sobel's Task Force on Minorities that said the state had a racially biased curriculum founded on an assumption of superiority for white European culture. Not all educators are pleased with Sobel's suggestion. The New York State United Teachers Organization says it could polarize people by focusing too much attention on race. Another group says it's not pleased with Governor Cuomo's recently unveiled budget proposal. The Alliance for the Mentally Ill of New York has joined that growing chorus. Spokeswoman Jean Hebb.
The inpatient staff will be cut. There will be more psychiatric patients discharged from the psych centers. There will be a reduction of community support services because there is no money for cost of living adjustment, which means basically a constriction of the programs. So we are coming out at a loss. And this is very hard on us.
Hebb says thousands of people who need care are not getting it, and she says if Cuomo's budget plan is approved, many more will have to do without. That's this week's Legislative Notebook. I'm Paul Rosenthal.
And that does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is produced by Inga Sarda with technical assistance from Phil Sluzars. This program made possible with grants from the Legislative Gazette, the newspaper about state government. Subscription information available at 518-473-6482. And Empire Information Services, serving New York and New England with electronic news release distribution. For the Gazette, I'm Don Decker.